likely to accelerate as more fires create conditions for even faster melts. Researchers found that snowpacks on south-facing slopes scorched by the Cameron Peak fire reached their maximum level 22 days earlier than north-facing slopes, and that snow melted completely a full 11 days earlier. Snowpacks in burned areas stay colder in winter due to a lack of thermal energy normally produced by trees, but the energy balance flips during warmer months when there's no shade from the sun. Reese adds earlier snowmelts in burn areas are also making it more challenging for forests and other vegetation to recover.
Currently, there is nearly no canopy in these burned areas, and that canopy is going to take decades, if it ever regrows, just due to climate change and changing environments.
Wildfires are increasingly burning at high elevations that accumulate deep snowpacks, and Reese expects this will present persistent challenges for water managers in Colorado and across the Mountain West.
That's just going to continue to have major impacts on our water resources for decades to come, and the impact of that as more fires are continuing is going to be cumulative.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael worries when what's raining down isn't water.
September brought a flood of heavy rains around the world. Hurricane Helene dropped enough water in the southeast to fill Lake Tahoe and kill over 150. About as many dead in Nepal with their highway to the outside world cut off by mud and landslides. Drought in hydropower-dependent Ecuador caused major blackouts. The Amazon continues to burn, deadly wildfires in Portugal, while it's just sustained heat killing folks in our southwest. War's effects can be as spectacular, but have much deeper effects over time. Israel's invading Lebanon. The other day, Israel missiled Yemen. Yesterday, Iran missiled Israel. What do borders mean? Ownership is everything. Hurricanes, floods, wildfires, etc. care nothing about borders, territorial claims. A downpour of missiles, the winds of war. Not the type of weather anyone wants to see. A flood of tears, possibility of firestorms, 100% chance of precipitation and escalation. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 2nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Hannah Francis. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, Eric Galatis, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our lovely members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be speaking with Barbara Bernstein about an upcoming screening of her documentary, Once a Braided River.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Hannah Francis.
We're speaking with Barbara Bernstein, one of KBOO's own show hosts of Locus Focus. Today, we're talking about her documentary, Once a Braided River, that will be screened this Saturday, October 5th at 3 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's fun to be on this other side of the mic.
Excellent. Yes. So you've been a host of Locus Focus for many years. You cover such a wide range of important topics on your show, from stormwater management to carbon trading, voter suppression, salmon restoration. I could spend the rest of News In Depth listing everything that you've covered. What made you focus in on the Willamette River and its history for your documentary?
Well, actually, I started focusing on climate issues and particularly fossil fuel development back in 2013. I did my first documentary that was really on that issue. And in the course of doing that documentary, which was really about things that were going on in Idaho and Montana and the tar sands, I found out that there was this plan to build the largest oil-by-rail terminal in Vancouver, Washington, the largest in North America. And I also noticed as I was going up to do some interviews in Seattle that there were these oil trains that were parked around Centralia. So I realized that this whole thing that I'm thinking about being in other places was hitting here. And a lot of other things happened while I was doing that documentary. The city of Portland, the city council, and particularly our mayor then, Charles Hales, was planning a sort of scheming to build a very, very large liquid propane terminal, the Pembina, who's famous also for Jordan Cove, that they were going to build in Portland right across from Hayden Island. And so and that was defeated. Like, it was a beautiful thing. It happened within a matter of months that it was over. And in fact, I interviewed Charlie Hales about it about a year later, and he said that the reason why he came to realize that it needed to be done away with, what there were more people in Portland who agreed that Pembina should go than agreed on the color of the sky.
It's rare.
So it just kept building, and it became aware the Vancouver Energy oil-by-rail terminal in Vancouver was defeated. It was a shorter struggle than a lot of the other ones that I followed. And then, of course, Jordan Cove has been going on most of my life, and that I got involved in covering that. I've been covering it on Locus Focus for years, but it became part of my documentary in 2019, and I started going down there and doing a lot of interviews. So that's kind of my focus. And then I'm trying to think about what got me started on the Willamette River. Part of it was, I know what it was. It was Zenith Energy. Mm-hmm. And that, which had snuck in after we'd banned fossil fuel infrastructure expansion. And so I was working on that and discovering, like with a lot of other activists, that there's a lot more to the oil tanks that are the oil tank farm that's down there along Highway 30 and the river besides Zenith. And in fact, it's a huge problem. And so that's what kind of inspired Once a Braided River. But I have to give two credits. One was Sarah Taylor, who started an organization along with several people called the Braided River Campaign. And that was who I started meeting with. And it was beginning of COVID, and I wasn't sure how I could ever do a radio documentary again and interview people in person. But we were meeting over Zoom, and I started just learning a lot about the river from her and the people that were part of this group. And then Bob Salinger, who's really featured in this. And at one of the meetings, he said something about how the Willamette River was once a braided river. And I said to him right after the meeting, I want that for the title for my show. He said, sure.
It's a beautiful title.
Seriously. Organizations like 350PDX, the Sunrise Movement, and other climate justice organizations have been talking about this issue of Zenith Oil in North Portland and the dangers of its facility in the aftermath of the Cascadian subduction earthquake. What are your thoughts on those efforts? How can people take action on these kinds of local issues?
Well, actually, there was a gathering I was going to go to Sunday that I was too blown out to go to, but I was talking to a friend today who went to it, and it was about what to do with the tank farms and how to decommission them. And there were two interesting people who spoke, one who was saying that we can't move the tank farms because there's all this oil pipeline infrastructure and gas pipeline infrastructure, and it's too hard to move the infrastructure. So we'll have to reinforce the tanks themselves, and that's the only way to deal with it. This other guy, Jay Wilson, who's featured in Once a Braided River, who I have a lot of faith in, and he said there's no way to really reinforce these tanks that are going to be safe, and particularly in the Cascade subduction zone earthquake. So my friend was saying, so what do we do? And of course, one of the things that the easiest thing to do is to first get rid of the empty tanks, because there's a number of empty tanks. We don't know. Zenith, as a matter of fact, they were supposed to, all the tank farm owners were supposed to, according to Oregon state law that was passed 3 years ago, and assess how much retrofitting they need to make their tanks safe. Zenith, out of, I'm not sure how many tanks they have, like 84 or something, they only get assessments for four. And Chevron wants more time, and we're just back to like thinking, realizing that the fossil fuel industry thinks they can just play us along. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is to really stand up to them. And though I think the first thing is to elect a new city government, new city council.
We're in the process of doing.
Yeah, which is happening. And just really listen to, go to as many candidate forums as you can and see who's talking about the CEI hub, the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, in reality. There's two people who I interviewed for one of the Running on Air shows a couple weeks ago who were pretending to be concerned about the CEI hub, but the things that they said made me think, no, they really aren't concerned about it. So really dig deep, and if somebody says that you can take money from the Portland Clean Energy Fund and use it to fill potholes, that person is not serious about really cleaning up the CEI hub. But I think that getting rid of the tanks that are empty and really pushing the companies that own these tanks to do these assessments in a timely fashion, because they're supposed to be done now, and it's still not going to solve the problem, because they still have 10 years to deal with retrofitting their tanks. And that's, the earthquake can happen any moment, as we know.
Right.
So I think mainly just to stay informed, and to, one of the organizations that I've been working with for a couple of years now, which is doing wonderful work, is Rumble on the River. And we do these panel discussions, these community forums, which are mostly once a month. We've kind of not had that many recently because of summer and other stuff. But we're starting again, and there's actually going to be a online Rumble on October 16th, and it's going to be about NextEnergy, which is out at Port Westward next to Klatskanai, where they want to build the largest largest renewable diesel refinery on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Actually, it wouldn't be on the West Coast, but it'd be as big as the huge ones that are there, that are kind of converting to renewable diesel on the San Francisco Bay. So I would recommend, you know, going to these panels and really learning and getting in touch and seeing people who are really active, and that's the way.
Right. There's there's a huge community out there, and they're ready for more people to join them. Could you expand on what the documentary is specifically about, and what you're trying to get across with it?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's kind of a love letter to the Willamette River. I live in Selwood, and I live five blocks from the river, and I've been living there for 31 years. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I moved to that neighborhood is, for 15 years before that, I was taking my dog to walk on this incredible beach. So I've had this connection with the Willamette, and it's kind of like I always wanted to live in a river town, and I did live in a river town, but the river was culverted underground. So I came to Portland, and so there's this river, but there's these walls around it, and it was really kind of a strange way to relate to a river. I lived outside of Boston, and even the Charles River had more access to the river than the Willamette River had when I moved here. So I had this connection to the river for a really long time, and as I started learning about the history of the Willamette and how much it's been abused, and one of the questions that I had when I first moved to Portland is, where is Swan Island? I don't see an island. Mm-hmm. And then you continue up the freeway, and there's a sign for Giles Lake, and I go, there's no lake. Mm-hmm. So that was a mystery I wanted to solve. And so in this documentary, people solve that problem for us. Mm-hmm. And of course, Swan Island was an island, and the main channel of the Willamette River, before white settlers came and wanted to turn the river into a freeway, basically, was between the east bank of the river and Swan Island, which is no longer water.
Right.
And then the west bank was, you could walk across it. It was like, and that's the whole thing. What a braided river means is that and the Columbia River was braided. There's still parts that are braided from the estuary down, and actually from Portland down. And the Willamette River was braided probably for the last 20, 25 miles of the river. The only braiding that you have any sense of all is like around Selwood with Ross Island, mm-hmm. which has been majorly changed, and also around West Lynn, there's a couple of beautiful islands. But before it was dredged and changed dramatically, the, you could walk across the river, it, probably not in the winter, but definitely in the late summer, between Swan Island and the West Bank.
Wow.
So what they did is, and then there was Giles Lake, which there was a series of these lakes, and this is all part of the braided river. There were all of these lakes and wetlands that were the last 10 miles of the river up between like Swan Island and the confluence with the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm.
And so... They dredged all the lakes, Giles Lake and the other two lakes that were there, and used the drill, the fill that they dredged from the lakes to fill that channel between Swan Island and the east bank of the Willamette, which is why Swan Island's now a peninsula. So that's the kind of stuff that I've been playing with and wanting to really understand how the river was transformed and how it became. When I came here, it was really polluted. I mean, much worse than it is now, actually. And I remember when the salmon were listed as an endangered species and all kinds of stuff that's going on. And appreciating that this is an amazing salmon river. And if we don't do something to really clean up the river and really make it healthy again and provide a little bit more of that braided nature of the river and sandy beaches and that that we will lose the salmon. And so this is why I produced the film.
Thank you.
So important.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Sorry to cut you off. I could listen to you, honestly, all night. Where can folks find more information about the screening and the documentary?
Well, you can go to the website, which is onceabraidedriver.org. And on the front page, there's a listing for the screening. And it's being presented by the 5th Annual Beaver Festival, along with the Media Project, which is our nonprofit, and Rumble on the River, and KBOO.
Fantastic.
Right on.
Thank you so much. We were just in conversation with Barbara Bernstein, host of Locus Focus on Mondays from 10 to 11 a.m., and director of the documentary Once a Braided River. She will be hosting a screening on Saturday, October 5th at 3 p.m. at the Multnomah Art Center. Thank you for listening to KBOO's News in Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to discuss the latest in the Oregon art world. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea. I always like talking with you.
Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with us about the goings-on in the art world. I want to start here in the Portland area, specifically the Old Town neighborhood. This week, there's an event series put on by Vanport Mosaic called Coming Home, which has been covered at Oregon Arts Watch. What can you tell me about this event series?
Yeah, there we have a couple of stories. One is by Amy Wang, and Dimay Lo Roberts also did a podcast, the Stage and Studio podcast. And Coming Home is this interesting series of events happening in Old Town Portland. And part of the idea is to preserve the history of underrepresented communities. It talks about mostly about the history of Chinese, Japanese, and Black pioneers in that area. This group received a big national grant. It was an exciting event. They are one of 14 events happening across the country. They were one that was selected out of like 375 applicants. So it speaks to how important this project is, how valuable it is. And the Old Town events are happening through October 5th, and they're all free. So there's still an opportunity to see them. I believe they're happening down in Old Town in the 2020 building, and you can read more about it in the two stories, a story in the podcast that we have.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting, especially with all of the cultural conversation that Portland has about Old Town that doesn't necessarily center the history of the neighborhood. In particular, I think there was somebody talking about how there's a new sort of sneaker incubator plan for the area or something like that.
Oh, I don't know much about that. When I'm fascinated to learn more. What these groups are trying to sort of talk about is the idea of memory activism, which is an interesting term. It's trying to remember and uplift the histories of communities that have been omitted or overlooked. And so that's sort of a part of the idea, just saying that these histories have lived there in Old Town. They exist there, and so they should be honored and preserved and be part of our plans that we make now to be inclusive.
Well, thank you for explaining that. I want to move over to a different part of Oregon. In Newburgh, you all have a story out called La Joie Theater Adds New Jewel to Chehalem Cultural Center Crown. Talk to me about the Chehalem Cultural Center and what they offer there.
Yeah, they have been working on this project for about 20 years, so it's a pretty big, cool deal that they have just opened this brand new theater. It seats 250 people. This whole building goes back decades. I think it was originally built in the 1930s as a WPA project. It was a school long ago, so it's always been in the public domain. And this vision for it to be a fully used cultural center has been going on these, you know, 20, even more than 20 years. But the idea of it being this theater space has been about 20. So it's now in this heart of a rather rural area. This small community has this significant cultural center that has a lot of different offerings. It has just not only this theater that just opened, it has event spaces like a grand ballroom. It has a whole commercial kitchen with a culinary art studio. It has a ceramic studio, recording studio, music practice rooms, a movement studio, and it has as many as 6 gallery spaces. And so it's just this really significant piece for the community right in the heart of Newburgh now. Community centers are important to weave together, you know, the social fabric of a community. A lot of people come together that might have completely diverse backgrounds and ideas, and yet they can all sort of be communal in this space. And so I think that the fact that they've opened this new space is a significant milestone for them. It's a big deal.
I was very interested to read throughout the story just how much work it took to convert this from what was a high school into something that would really work for the community, and that it's been sort of put together piece by piece of all of the different types of arts that are being served at that one center.
Yeah, it's been a long process. Very community-minded people have championed this for a very long time. And now they have the executive director, Sean Andrews, is there. He's been there since maybe 2017 or so. And it's just the fact that they have just stuck with it all these years and built it piece by piece. And now that they have this, you know, vision. It's thought of as these cultural centers exist around the state in various ways, and they all serve their communities in unique ways. And so they're thought of as just being these sort of small but mighty spaces, something for everyone, and just a real significant piece that can really jumpstart the economy there in Yamhill County. So I'm really kind of excited for them.
Oregon Arts Watch also has a piece out about the Bend and Eugene exhibitions of late Oregon artist Rick Bartow's work. What should folks know about him?
Yeah, Rick was a really, really interesting artist. He died in 2016, and he still has this like larger-than-life presence and influence in the area. He lived in Newport, Oregon, but he was known nationally and even internationally. He had ties with the Maori communities in Australia, New Zealand, and he has, it doesn't mention in the story, but he actually has these big outdoor sculptures that are featured outside the Smithsonian's National Museum of American Indian in Washington, D.C. So these three exhibits that are now, they are at the High Desert Museum in Bend, at the Karin Clark Gallery in Eugene, and at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. And Bartow had this, he had very expressive, colorful work. They often featured the transformation of people and animals, the sense of two beings in some place. So he'd like to capture that sense of transition, something, you know, metamorphosizing. So this, you know, exciting sort of change and dual personality that creatures could have. He was known for just very quick markings that were kind of expansive. And so I'm glad to see that all these years after Rick's death, he still has these significant shows going on.
Well, last time we spoke, we were talking about the first part of this series, and now the second part of a series is out in Oregon Arts Watch on the Supreme Court decision Warhol Foundation v. Goldsmith, which comes from writer David Slater. And that decision put forward a new standard for talking about copyrights, saying that works that are appropriated or derived from other artworks or changed have to be judged on a standard of whether they compete commercially with that original artwork. But this relationship between art and the idea of copying is much more complex than that, and that's kind of discussed in this piece. Talk to me about this article. What's it about?
Yeah, so David Slater is an artist and a retired attorney, so he's familiar with legal aspects of, you know, the law and how it relates to art. He explores this case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided back in November. As you mentioned, it's Goldsmith versus the Warhol Foundation. This photographer, Lynn Goldsmith, had a photo that Andy Warhol, the well-known pop artist, used to create several images of Prince, the musician Prince. And had one-time rights, and then when a publication asked to use another Prince image, that the Warhol Foundation granted that, but the photographer said that they had one-time rights those years earlier, they didn't have rights again. So that's where it comes from, this whole decision. But what it does is it sort of changes the idea of the notion of fair use and how artists can borrow from other artists' work and ideas to build on. So David Slater, the part one kind of discussed the case, and the part two now, he talks about how art often is derivative of other forms of art. It builds on, it borrows ideas, it's a form of knowledge that continues to advance and build on itself, progress, just like any other way of thinking, any other science form, you know, medicine. NASA couldn't do its work without Copernicus. You know, it's how we build on knowledge, and artwork works the same way, always pushing new ideas. So he explores now how you can see how artists use ideas they're inspired by and work on concept that other artists have used. And so this piece explores that. And then his third part will talk to local artists and how this ruling affects them. So I'm curious to know how that will play out.
Yeah, it was cool to read the article because he does take a historical look, and so there are paintings and sculptures and things that people might recognize, and then, you know, reading it and getting to see that compared to the earlier versions, I think helps to illustrate that it's not just as simple as, well, this copied or used a part of this, and therefore that's bad.
It's kind of a nice little microcosm of art history. It talks about how the Romans borrowed from the Greeks, who borrowed from the Egyptians, who, you know, influenced work later. It's fun to see the two compared. I was familiar with quite a few of them, but some of them were new to me. So it was fun to see how they compare and how much alike they are throughout history, and how we use different ideas from different cultures and different artists.
Well, even the most revered, respected, you know, name recognition artists, Picasso, Manet, whoever, were doing this copying or borrowing or riffing.
Right. And it talks about how Van Gogh used Millet's work, famous works that you'd recognize. So it's interesting to see, oh, they got their ideas there. Now, I always find that a thrilling part of going to museums and discovering those associations. So his story kind of is a little bit of that, those aha moments.
If our listeners are interested in reading more about any of the stories that we touched on, what's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, our artswatch.org. We have lots of stories. It's the beginning of the month right now, so we have a lot of columns, Lit Watch, Drama Watch, Dance Watch, Viz Arts Watch, the layout, all of the events happening for the whole month of October. So Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Lots to watch, it sounds like.
Yes, lots to watch. We've got all the columns with watches.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, always love talking to you, Athea. Can't wait to talk again.
That was Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about the latest in the Oregon art world. More information on the stories we discussed is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Al.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO is hosting the first Friday's Arts Walk on